Auto friends, it's Dr. Jason Fox here. Acquisitive ambiguity, most fantastic. In this episode, I'm going to be sharing with you most of what I know about facilitating a strategic offsite. So this is going to be useful for you if you lead a team and you know that your context is changing and at some point you need to bring people together to sense check what you're doing and to make sure that you're orientating towards enduring relevance. This could also be useful for you if you are a consultant or a facilitator who may find themselves in a situation where you're hosting a strategic offsite. So this is going to be a longer episode. I intend to take my time with this one. And one of the common things that I hear, the common quibble that I hear when people share that they listen to the podcast is that I speak too fast. It's because I tend to think fairly swiftly, but I'm going to do my best to keep this at a relaxed pace, but really we are going to be going deep. Facilitating strategy offsites is something I have been doing for at least the last decade. I found myself working on this after the Game Changer, my first major published book, came out. And this is what was the genesis of How to Lead a Quest. And when I was doing the Game Changer, so many folks invited me to their strategy sessions in order to gamify their workforce or gamify their customer onboarding or gamify insert whatever. And some of the rudimentary questions I had, questions that any complexity practitioner would ask, were often met with blank stares. I would ask, what other things have we considered, or what other options here, or do we actually need to gamify this? What are we choosing to not choose? What are we pretending to not know? And I realized that there was this proclivity when executives are busy to favor quick fixes, familiar solutions, and default ways of doing things. And after having been brought on board and paid to professionally contribute to many strategic offsites, I saw a pattern in that most executives are very busy, no one really has time, and because we're time poor, it's natural that we favor the quick fixes, the familiar solutions, and the default ways of doing things, although we don't want to admit it, so we try to look for the flavor of the month, the shiny new bright thing that's the same thing with a different veneer. And then we do that thing. And then, of course, if we're doing a strategic offsite well, we'll come to points of contention where there are conflicting values, conflicting commitments. There's a paradoxical tension. But normally what would happen is someone would look at their watch and say, come on, we're way off track here. And everyone will agree, we'll settle for the lowest common denominator, the thing that maximizes harmony amongst the room. And at the end of the day, we'll be staring at a set of goals that looks eerily similar to last year's goals, and we'll call it good strategy. And there are a lot of folks that make a lot of money kind of engineering this theater. And there are contexts where this kind of theater makes sense. I'm more interested in folks that are willing to venture into emergent domains. You know, I'm going to be sharing with you an approach that's post-conventional or atypical, yet seems to have worked very well. I've worked across many industries. Had to write them down, so many. Like C-suite executives of multinationals, vice chancellors and their teams, heads of research organizations, founders of medium enterprises, the project leads of skunkworks, which are like secret projects within a larger organization. In deep tech, I've done so many things in between: military, police forensics, law firms, cotton farmers, Wagyu farmers, fast manufactured consumer goods, franchises, medical technology, pharmaceuticals, big tech, the big ones, governments, and much more. And when I list this out, it seems quite mercenary. My point is not to flex, although I do want to establish some credibility here. My point is mostly that across the different contexts, no matter what industry, sometimes what country, largely that there are patterns that exist. And when we can approach this from a metasystemic or meta-rational perspective and start to discern the underlying patterns that work, then we kind of have a bit more of an efficacious toolkit to bring to strategic offsites. But what I'm about to share with you, I hope that it is received in the spirit of, in the spirit of adding to your quiver of options. These are not mandates. There are no best practices within emergent domains. There's only novel practices. What's worked for me, you know, it's me sharing my situational acuity and some of the dispositions and sensibilities that have worked in the context that I found myself in, but that doesn't mean it's going to always work for you. And so we need to approach this like a trickster. Better to have better to have like a way but to imbibe it with a bit of humor and to make use of the tools that emerge, and better to have no way at all, no established way at all, and to renew and imbibe and update your way situationally with whatever is emergent. Like the point of all of this is to stay present to emergence. When you are doing strategy in emergent domains, your role is to tend to the conditions for emergence. You have a sense of directionality, a sense of where you want to head, and that is largely under the banner of enduring relevance. Whatever it is you're doing in your business or organizational context, you want to make sense in the future. So that means that you want your business model to make sense, you want your operating systems to make sense, you want your products to make sense, the communication, the way that you do things needs to make sense, it needs to be coherent. An example I often use is if you were advertising your business today using the telephone book, one would say that's an incoherent activity because of the internet. 40 years ago, it might have made complete sense, but today it makes no sense whatsoever. There are things that we're doing right now that already don't make sense. Let them alone will make no sense whatsoever in about 5 years' time, 2 years' time, or even next month. The key here, thus, is always orientating towards relevance realization. I make the distinction here of meaningful progress as distinct from the delusion of progress. That's what I write about in How to Lead a Quest. And what I've written about in in many other domains. I should probably just point out too, I don't necessarily believe strategy offsites are a great way to do strategy development. It's often how strategy development is ostensibly done, seemingly done, but that's not where strategy comes from. Having said that, I am a mercenary wizard. I do play my role in strategy offsites, normally to contribute perspectives from out of left field to freshen things up and to hopefully get folks to venture a little bit beyond their default, or to recognize where default thinking, the safe, familiar, predictable patterns, may be getting in the way of meaningful progress. Meaningful progress is that which brings us closer to future relevance. The delusion of progress is where default thinking gets in the way of meaningful progress. It is very easy to delude ourselves into a false sense of progress because we seem to have a narrowed focused metric obsession where we tend to believe that if numbers are going up and if we're ticking all the right boxes and if we're doing the work, then we are doing our job and moving closer to future relevance. And this can be an incredible delusion. So compelling, so deceptive, it ensnares the best of us. And partly my role as an external wizard and your role too as a consultant or even as a maverick leader is to disrupt subtly perhaps the default frames so that we can allow room for emergence and the emergence of novel pathways. A novel pathway is that which could not have been predicted before. So many people go into strategic offsites with a sense of the end in mind, and you'll probably hear this advice, you know, but what does success look like? Or start with the end in mind. This is a recipe for underwhelming success. It is very easy to conjure the theater, the pantomime. We can conjure the outcomes, whatever outcome you want. We can lead an offsite that will result in that outcome. It'll tick all of your boxes. People will score it 4 out of 5. They'll say it was good. And the result is you have no idea of the beautiful, exquisite novel pathways that could have emerged had we tended to those conditions. But it takes courage and bravery to tend to the conditions of emergence. We need to have the courage to lean into ambiguity and paradox and nebulosity and doubt and non-linearity. What do I mean by that? In complex adaptive systems, the parts don't relate to each other in a linear fashion. A lot of people approach business model innovation, business model strategy, operating systems as though it were a machine. And this is very appealing because you can pull a machine apart, look at all the bits, find the problems, improve, fix, replace the bits, and then put it back together and the machine keeps working. But most businesses are complex entities. They're made up of relations, interrelated parts of different people that in themselves are complex beings. And most organizations, all organizations, work within a complex context. Our world is changing rapidly right now. We have exponential changes with regards to how knowledge works with artificial intelligence. We have ongoing geopolitical turbulence. And this is to the backdrop of a potential meta crisis and so on. We need to keep our wits about us and orientate effectively. Hence why I'm doing this extended episode on how to facilitate a strategic offsite or strategy development. probably a strategy offsite, but let's get into this a little bit first. My point being there is the strategy offsite is not a good place to develop strategies. Too, like, people are busy coming together just for a day or two or even three to come up with a new strategy. It's optimistic. Better that strategy is a living conversation within the organization. Better that future relevance is something that is a shared concern for all people within the team. Better that we are attending to the cultivation of a quiver of options, as I talk about in How to Lead a Quest. And when we do come together for a strategic offsite, it's to have the conversations we don't otherwise get time to have. The thorny conversations, the complex, the entangled, the wicked ones, the ones that evoke conflicting values and have non-obvious answers. That's what we have a strategic offsite for. But let me get to the question that I was asked. I'm going to get to this later. It's a question largely about how do I approach strategic offsites, but it makes a little bit more sense that I do a bit more preamble for you. You'll find that a lot of what I share, this is frustrating for most people. We're in an age right now where people want quick, easy, cheap answers. Better to just ask Grok or Chatty or, you know, whatever ChatGPT or large language model for an easy answer, and it will spit one out and it will be compelling. It'll have face validity. And for most folks, it'll suffice. But this is not the pathway to reliable strategic differentiation. I'm not saying eschew artificial intelligence. Everyone's using it. It's rivalrous, obligate technology at the moment. We have to be using it. We have to be savvy, and we have to keep our wits about us. But the point of my slowing things down is to resist the automaticity, because a lot of people just want to have strategy in a sense where they tick a box and get it done. And most executives are spending most of their time attending to operational matters. And this can, in the short term, feel like we're doing the right thing. And there's never a good time for a strategy offsite. Everyone's busy all the time. We're in a distraction economy now. It takes a counterintuitive courage in order to carve out the time, rally the folks together, have them primed so as to make the most of our time together without crowding it with content or junking it up with unnecessary information and really allowing space for generative ambiguity so that deep things can be resolved and novel pathways can emerge. But before we get into it, if we're talking about a strategy offsite, a key thing that I have in mind is who is calling the offsite? And this is important for you. If it's a CEO of a large or multinational organization, they have a board to report to. They have shareholders that they need to be mindful of. And they have fiduciary responsibilities. And that means that there's going to be a lot of risk mitigation. For solo consultants like myself, it's usually only a small role. They were largely paid a lot of money to large consulting firms to do all the number crunching, all the statistical analysis, to look at what margins can be tightened and what markets can be entered into. And it's largely out of my depth. The role that I play in these instances is working at a fairly high cognitive complexity level with the senior leaders to ensure that we're not missing anything and to ensure that the gravitational pull towards inertia and towards the status quo and towards the default and that is disrupted. So in a CEO context of a large multinational, what I'm trying to just ground you with is if you've got these grand visions of changing the world, you'll have to move quietly and plan things. There's a lot of overhead in these contexts. And sometimes you can get a charismatic CEO that has influence and has authority, and they've brought together a fantastic team. They sometimes work in founder-led organizations. But in a mature organization, it's going to be a different landscape. That's not to say that bold things can't happen. Of course they can. It's just we just need to be mindful that there are different tensions going in. If you're a director, if you're working with a director, say a government department, you know, there's going to be bureaucratic requirements for them too. Often in these senses, people need to come up with a strategic plan. And strategic plans are an anathema to emergence. In most of the contexts that I've worked with in government, they need highly detailed plans with, like, you know, looking as far out as 3, sometimes 5 years, planning how resources will be allocated, what we'll be doing, what the project milestones are, what the budgets are, what the critical path dependencies are. And it's just this wonderful fabrication of illusion, hopes and dreams and intention that is the plan itself is, as a strategy thing, useless, but planning is useful. The plan itself might be useful in a strategic context, but actually it has some merit in a propaganda sense because people like to have a sense of what they're working towards. And so if it's framed properly, it makes sense sometimes to have a roadmap, although I like calling it a mud map more than a roadmap because a mud map allows you to be a little bit more broad stroke, a little less committed to details. You can accept that things will change. The tide might come in and wash away the map and we'll have to redraw it. The mud map kind of means that we're paying more attention to the conceptual relations, but a roadmap, or even worse, a blueprint, which is highly detailed with all the moving parts, like you can just sense the Parkinson's law, the effort expanding to the time allocated. You can sense the consultants that will make so much money creating unnecessary PDF documents and PowerPoint presentations and a whole heap of work because the director within the organization needs to justify what they're doing. They need to justify their budget. And, you know, if they're good at their role, they'll have a meta-rational awareness. They'll know that this is a game that needs to be played, that there are boxes that need to be ticked, and at the same time, they'll be making provisions for emergence. They'll be doing a both-and move. Similar to my friend who leads within a hospital, there are always rules to follow within a hospital context. The best practice, gold standard, the correct legal way to do things. And then there is the actual on-the-ground, pragmatic, grounded, highly informed, intuitive sense of what needs to be done by the nurses, the doctors, the folks actually working to save patients' lives. There's this exquisite tension between the two modes where we realize, of course, we can't stray from our ethical obligations, from our legal obligations, from all of the standards that we have. At the same time, we need to be mindful of the necessary wriggle room and how we be savvy so that we don't have people die, or in the instance of the director within a public institution that wants to ensure that what they're doing is actually efficacious, you know, that they've got the wriggle room to ensure that that's happening. This was a context that came to me recently when working with a bunch of principals. Principals have student outcomes in mind. They care about the students within schools. They want them to be prepared for the world that they're growing up into, not the world that the teachers grew up in, but the world that the students will grow up in. Teachers often care about this too. And yet we're in a system where there are bureaucratic expectations and requirements that often get in the way of real learning. And the savvy teachers, the savvy principals create the conditions where real learning can occur, even whilst ticking the boxes of the educational bureaucracy and requirements. So the director is another thing. And then, of course, you've got the founders. And founders are usually great because they're close to the business. They can make things happen. They've got the charisma, the influence, the authority, the mandate to actually be able to call the shots. But then often founders are either they're feeling a bit lonely because they have to be always doing the strategic thinking themselves, and they've hired folks who haven't got skin in the game. All they do, but they're thinking of succession and they're wanting to kind of step back and actually have an external like you come in to facilitate so that they don't have to be holding all of the space, because there's a lot of energy that takes to hold a strategy offsite. Or they might be mindful of their tendency to dominate these conversations, and they may be aware that at the point in the business, they may have been great scaling it from 0 to 1, but as they're going from 1 to 10, they may be getting in the way. And if they have that awareness and they've recruited great talent, then being an external to help manage the dynamics so that the novel pathways can emerge and the things that need to be said are surfaced. And that's a good thing. So a question I always have is who's calling the offsite? In a public context, you can't just have one person call the shots. It needs to kind of emerge in all contexts. You want to actually get some sense of what's emerging from the front lines. You want to integrate perspectives so you're not just having elitist executives off in their ivory towers coming up with strategic plans that make no sense for the folks that are working and interfacing with customers and clients. You kind of need to do a deep sense making for the strategy to make sense. Hence why Don't Believe strategy actually exists within the context of a sole offsite. But the next question I have is, are they actually looking to develop a strategy, or is the strategy already mostly set and they're looking to discuss it, to test it, to have the team digest it, to metabolize it, or do they want it to be challenged and it's kind of in draft form and they're kind of wanting to sense check? Or is it more that it's all set and done, but they need to stage a kind of innovation theater so that the wider organization feels like they've had a part in it? This often looks like post-it notes on the walls and voting on pointless things so that everyone feels like they've contributed. But it's important to know what the context really is here. Is it strategy development or is it strategy communication? And you'll always have to balance. You've got the client, the person who has had the initiative, who has reached out, who is hiring you, the economic decision maker. But then you've got the audience as well, which is the client's colleagues, assuming that they're CEO, the founder, the director. And there's always the thing that when the client is briefing you, you've got to keep your wits about you and hold that in suspension, because it could turn out that the client themselves may be a bottleneck to the very thing that they want to help conjure. So it's empathetic, but you need to kind of keep a professional acuity about what might be emerging, not to latch onto things too swiftly. I'll just take a quick aside here. I'm going to reference the old Hedgehog and the Fox. There's very different approaches to strategy development. In the tale, The Hedgehog and the Fox by, I forget his name. It's a classic one. I'll put it in the show notes. In the classic tale, The Hedgehog and the Fox, Fox has trying so many things to get at the hedgehog. The hedgehog can just curl up and has its defenses. The parable is that the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one thing really well. And I have this as a vague, very light heuristic in how I'm orientating here. In established domains, and if people are looking to just do strategy that is within an established domain, so they're effectively looking to optimize within an established domain, hedgehog antics work well. Hedgehogs know what to do and they know it very well. And so if you're in a context that isn't changing, that's not subject to the same volatility that many organizations are in the world at the moment, you might be doing manufacturing of essential materials, or it might be a kind of a service that doesn't really change too much, like say, and there's no regulatory changes. So like say it's you're a dentist or I don't know, I'm trying to find larger organizational contexts that aren't really subject to change. It's kind of hard. Maybe you're a cotton farmer or something like that. Even then, though, there's a lot of things changing with regards to carbon credits and how land is worked. So anyway, if you're in an established place, hedgehog antics work. And by that, I mean, you have default ways of doing things. You have thorough ways of doing things. You have a strategy offsite would look like a lot of analysis, a lot of graphs, a lot of numbers. And that the goal here is incremental improvement, tweaking an existing system. It's not the domain that I play in, or at least not the strength that I bring. If it's an emergent domain, as in if enough people in the leadership team sense that things are changing and we need to refresh or at least review our business model, our operating system, the products that we have, how we work with our clients and customers, how we deliver value into the market, the customer segments we work with, the partnerships we have, the activities we have, all of those things. A fox-like approach makes sense, and the fox knows many things, but not necessarily anything in particular. The reason I say this is because if you're going into a context where things are changing, you will want to not be an expert in the industry. Whereas if it's an established strategy to improve within an established domain, then it does make sense to hire industry experts. It's a bit of a delusion for you to think that you can be an expert of another person's industry unless you have a lot of experience in that industry. I don't have, when I come into a military context, a policing context, a pharmaceutical context, I mean, I've got some experience within academia, but if I come into vice chancelleries, if I come into, software as a service organizations, I'm not trying to pretend that I'm an expert in their industry. I mean, they'll be able to tell. They'll see right through the fake consultants that have done, you know, a bunch of ChatGPT and Googling and hacking together some sort of buzzword menagerie. That's not what you need to do. Your role is to bring outside insights into their context. And in a mythic sense, shamans would, the tribes that would have shamans usually had a competitive advantage over tribes that didn't have shamans, because the shaman would imbibe plant medicine, do astral travel, use masks, and get into trance, and effectively see things through different perspectives and bring new metaphors into the mix. And through those metaphors, the tribe was able to make better meaning, or at least to better sense-making, better capacity for diverse perspectives and orientation amidst complexity. Your role as a consultant facilitating a strategic offsite is to bring external metaphors into the mix. The reason they're hiring or looking to you as an external is because you have perspectives. And so my perspectives, my work across many industries allows me to situationally bring perspectives that could offer new ways of seeing things in the moment. We can't predict that in advance, though, because we're talking about emergence here. But having a clear sense of whether it's established or emergent and whether we're looking for a hedgehog or a fox is really important. Organizations that are looking for a hedgehog, you'll often have someone who has a book that they've read, and maybe it's every 5 years that the book gets updated, but it's kind of one thing. You've got to come in with, like, this is, I worked with one organization once, huge fans of James Clear's Atomic Habits, and the client wanted everyone to be across James Clear's Atomic Habits. It was an interesting session for me, because whilst I have a background in behavioral science and I appreciate a lot of what James has done, there are no one-size-fits-all solutions. And so I'm a fox. I can't really do the hedgehog game. But there are folks out there that are the getting things done folks, the atomic habits folks, the tiny habits folks, the BJ Fogg behavior model folks. There's folks out there that have the playing to win strategy book imbibed, and that's where you figure out where the competition is and how you're going to win. With the exception of Finite and Infinite Games, The Vision of Life as Play and Possibilities, there's no one book that I reference. It's much more mercurial, situational, adaptive, fluid, and that works for folks that are willing to venture into emergence and complexity and change. Not so well for folks that are looking for optimization within an established domain. Another question you might want to ask is, what is their context? Are things steady? Is it turbulent? Is there a sense of urgency? Many industries that I'm working with at the moment who haven't adopted the Quest Augmented Strategy approach that I wrote about in 2015, many industries have been blindsided by artificial intelligence, and the result is some sort of knee-jerk, reactive latching onto artificial intelligence, perhaps in a way that I would suggest isn't keeping their wits about them. It's a ideological attachment that is reducing the optionality that they have. Optionality means you have the ability to choose from various options based upon the conditions that manifest. Much of what we do when we augment our strategy with quests is cultivate a quiver of options, strategic initiatives we might deploy should the right conditions manifest. And then we monitor, we sense make, we continue a living conversation, we keep sense making into these fields, and when the situation feels right, we start to experiment. Those experiments, those safe to fail experiments, are what yield insight that enable us to imbibe strategic decision making so that it orientates us towards meaningful progress and not just perpetuating a rich delusion of progress. So it's never too late, though, to start engaging and cultivating in-house intelligence, even if it feels turbulent, even if it feels like we need to make a decision straight away. Decisions can be provisional. We can do this. But it's nice to get a sense of the strategic context. Is it turbulent? Is it stable? Is it changing? And then you'll want to get a sense of the strategic context for the meeting itself. Are we talking about product strategy? Is it business model strategy, where we're looking at the partnerships, the channels, the customer segments, the activities we do, the how revenue and cost? Are we looking at operational strategy? Are we looking at, you know, how decision-making authority works internally? Are we looking about how innovation works? What behaviors are incentivized? How we communicate? Or is it something much more existential, where it's time to actually have a deep, broad, an imaginative conversation about what it is that we actually do, the true value we provide, and where we're going? Or is it opportunistic and mercenary, where we don't really mind so much about relevance and more want to index salience, as in we get a sense that, yes, it's kind of bullshit, but this is a buzzword that a lot of people are going to be buying into. We need to be part of this scene because that will then position us well to get some funds to do this other thing. It's nice that you have a sense of what we're working with here. And then probably only a couple of questions left before I get into this. Another question I think is really important for you to ask is, and you might not ask this overtly, but it's a question that you need to have in mind, is how do incentives work in this context? You want to have a sense of who benefits from what. Is it an invested stakeholder leadership team, like where every leader has a bit of a stake within the organization? Or is it a salaried leadership team where there are performance bonuses? And if there are performance bonuses, what are those bonuses? Are there tensions between different divisions because of how budget or incentives or bonuses work? Is there an external firm that has been hired to create a strategy? All of these incentives result in different outcomes. And of course, all incentives have the capacity to generate unintended consequences or perverse outcomes. So the consulting firm you've hired to help you develop their strategy, your strategies, if they're getting paid for the strategy itself, then they'll want to do things that provide evidence of work, which usually end up taking up a lot of your time. And they'll want something that's highly aesthetic and designery and flash. And they'll usually do things that communicate value and effort. And that's great. We just need to make sure it's serving the context and moving closer to relevance realization. If you have an executive that is looking to retire soon and they have a mandate and they just want to hit a particular target within the next year, they may be disinclined to explore novel pathways. If you have people with conflicting bonuses that are tied to performance metrics, that may come under question if we are taking strategy seriously in the lens of, or earnestly, I should say, in the lens of relevance realization, that may create some skew because you're going to have people coming in here. And yes, of course, benevolently, everyone cares about the organization and we want the organization to succeed, etc. But also they have to worry about their own income and their own status and power and how things work. And, you know, we can't be in game denial here. It's a socio-political context. People have reputation, time, effort, energy invested into getting where they are. They don't want to have that put at risk. And so it's tricky, but having a sense of how the incentives work, who's getting paid what, and who's incentivized to do what may help to create extra clarity around some of the tensions that may be inherent within the organization. And then finally, does the leadership team have the capacity and the capability to engage in meta-rational or meta-systemic discourse? This is a thorny one. I don't want to get too carried away with adult development here and don't see it as a quality of the person themselves, but more of the capacity and perhaps a learned capability or a dispositional capability, which any one of us can learn with the right conditions. But can we actually have folks engage in meta-rational or meta-systemic conversation? Or are we going to have a room of busy executives that are looking to get shit done and keep things simple and will thus kind of force a mechanical, artificial simplicity on complexity and emergence? Because if that's the case, then any of this emergence talk is going to be a bit of a pantomime. We're going to be paying lip service, but eventually people will get frustrated. They'll be like, I just want a concrete plan. I just want clarity. I want role clarity. I want to know exactly what to do. I want to know, what does success look like? What's the goal? What are we measuring? And increasingly, over the last 10 years I've been doing this, I've found that the capability and capacity for leadership teams to hold complexity is diminishing. We are increasingly in a world that values quick fixes, familiar solutions, and default ways of doing things. That leads us into a sense where we've become cursed with efficiency. By being cursed with efficiency, we've become too good at finding quick fixes, familiar solutions, and default ways of doing things. That when it comes to the opportunity to explore genuine novel pathways, to actually contend with generative ambiguity, propulsive paradox, and contexts where things are emergent and unknown and unestablished, most folks cannot do this. Most folks will wait until others lead and other things. Most folks will wait until others lead And then when it's established, they'll step in. And this distinction between established contexts and emergent contexts is really at the heart of what I make a distinction in terms of what leadership looks like, what strategic leadership looks like. Many people are very comfortable optimizing operational performance within established paradigms. And that makes sense because you have the established defaults, you have the measurements, you have the best practice. The context is clear, or maybe it's complicated. Maybe you kind of, the machine you're operating in is complicated and you need to have governing constraints and work with other folks within the machine. But complex domains are emergent, they're living, they're nonlinear, they're nebulous, there's an inherent ambiguity, there's unknowns. It's a whole different disposition. And when you have leaders that have been groomed within clear and complicated contexts, and then they're asked to engage in an emergent conversation within a complex domain, my experience is, first and foremost, most don't have the capacity because this takes time. And this is the reason that we do an offsite. This is the reason that we actually get away from the enterprise context because it's filled with operational defaults, distractions, and we go to somewhere nice. And when we get there, we have a dinner and we keep it relaxed and we hope that people have a good sleep and we hope that they're well regulated in their nervous system. And we do things to reestablish the sense of collegiality, enthusiasm, mutual encouragement, support, trust within the team so that folks can then hazard half-formed ideas or thinking in draft that gives them, there's a different kind of courage or confidence that emerges within a well-designed offsite that's well-hosted and facilitated that enables conversations to be surfaced that otherwise would never be voiced, and particularly not in the default contexts. But we need to create capacity. And that means having people that are well-rested, well-hydrated, and that there is time. You need to have trust that the folks coming to this strategic offsite are able to delegate to folks in their team, that they have trust in their teams and they haven't created these weird dependencies. You know, the role of a good leader is like the role of a good facilitator. We want to make ourselves redundant. The role of a leader is not to center yourself as the hero with all the answers, but to really create the conditions where you're no longer needed. You actually give birth to a constellation of visions. And it's not even you giving birth. You're tending to the emergent cosmic choir. But the point is, we want folks to arrive to offsites and not be distracted. You know, we can be halfway through a conversation. I've seen this happen. And during the lunch break, someone checks their emails and then they get pulled into a phone call and they're expansive, emergent, generative, creative, imaginal, liminal, embodied, emboldened, curious, whimsical thinking gets constrained and collapsed into operational frames once again. And that is what we're protecting against. So capacity is one thing. Capability is another. We are in a world that does not tolerate complexity, even though complexity is the orientation of the universe and all of evolution. Everything from the Big Bang, we are still part of the Big Bang. We are still unfurling into the cosmos. And higher orders complexity is where we ought to be orientating because that is the life that is flourishing, that is the eros of the universe. But it takes a different cognitive load and it's not as swiftly rewarded. And so what most folks will want to do is have false simplicity or artificial certainty, boxes that they can tick. And it's so limiting. So capacity and capability. At this point, I'm going to have a sip of water and I just want to take a moment to celebrate my favorite kind of client, the career executive. Most of the folks that I work with are career executives. This sounds like a slight kind of, it doesn't sound like a compliment necessarily, but I've come to really appreciate the role that they play. A career executive is someone who has served the role as an executive across, I would say, at least three different contexts. So as a side note, before I go into, fluffing up some of my clients and singing praises for the career executive, I just want to point out that I've sometimes worked with contexts where there has been a stable leadership for 20 plus years. And there is something so deep and empathetic within that context where you have folks that have risen through the ranks, their empathy for other frontline workers, for The organizational context is just, it's extreme and it makes sense. And it works particularly well in established domains. It can work well in emerging domains too. There is something deep and wonderful and nuanced, and I really want to honor that. I just want to point out that career executives tend to have these traits in common, that they're meta-rational. When I say meta-rational, I mean that they have the capacity to think about the limits of their own rationality and what they might be missing, and they're open to liminal, emergent, para-rational, other ways of seeing things. And meta-systemic means they haven't just been trained within one particular system. They've lived and worked within multiple systems, and that allows them to have the meta-context to compare and various systems. And so that way they're not blinded by any particular model about how things should be. They're not narrowed in their focus by cohering to only one particular framework, but instead they're able to integrate all of them and situationally synthesize whatever is most appropriate and apt to serve meaningful progress within the context that they are in. A lot of them tend to embody a kind of a fluid mode. There's a thing coming into a new context. You've been hired as a career executive because of your track record. You've done well in the conversations and the interviews. Part of the job of working as an internal agent within organizations is, you know, achieving results and being liked. And so these are folks, these career executives are genuinely pretty good at relationality. And they're pretty good at narrative strategy, and they're pretty good at their own mythopoetics. They understand that they have a reputation, and how they show up influences how others perceive them and the stories that others make of them. And, you know, a lot of large consulting firms are effectively social networks within a container loosely held within, well, not loosely held, but like a threaded together with incentives and a brand. And career executives, they know also that there's a wider ecology. There's a sense of, when you do well and you look after other folks, they look after you, and there's this kind of, there's this networked effect there. The main thing is that they're brought in because an organization, they're not achieving what they need to achieve, and often the goals are complex and they can't actually do this internally themselves because they haven't developed the capacity, the capability, perhaps not even the capacity, to have leaders lead in ways that are context disrupting. You know, one of the issues with leadership development I see, in a lot of contexts now is a fixation on skills development as opposed to sensibilities development. So skills are things that any one of us can learn at any time as we need. But sensibilities are knowing when to use the skills, knowing which skills to use when and when not to use the skills. So, for example, you might have done a non-violent communication course. It's fantastic. I love non-violent communication. But sometimes you might be using it in a stilted way that actually impedes in the relationality. It's like, cool that you have that. Keep it up your sleeve. But if it's late night at the bar and you're talking to, you know, a potential client for a large, I don't know, merger or something like that, you don't ham-fist that into the conversation. So sensibilities are what is needed, but it's often lacking. And so a career executive is hired and they come in, and what they do is they go about building a refresh strategy. They build rapport. They build alliance. They build narrative momentum around things. Then they hire folks like myself, perhaps like you, to come in and serve as a bit of a catalyst, a bit of a leader, a bit of an outside or an external voice that could be a narrative wedge to bring about and evoke ideological optionality to then catalyze decision-making around particular direction. I'll often work as an advisor accomplice with these career executives, so sounding board, where we're sense-making amongst complexity. I can share them the latest research so they look cool in what they do, help them with their keynotes and other presentations and maneuvering within the organization. And then they bring me in to help facilitate things. And because I have the insight as to what complex goal that they want to achieve, I can usually help them to catalyze their progress towards it. And then, you know, so that's fun. That's why I like working with such folks. They have a sense of the infinite game. They have the infinite player's glint, and they recognize the role of trickster in terms of disrupting established categorizations, established defaults, inverting paradigms, speaking truth to power, and tending to the conditions for emergence. And then what happens is one of three things. They'll either get bored because they've achieved the thing, and then the organization will start to, you know, become a bit too patterned for them, and the magic of their first 18 months or so within the organization has waned. And so in the next 6 months, they start to, you know, look for options. They start networking, they start having conversations. And then after 2 years, or maybe it's 3 years, they move on to the next organization. They may get booted. Another reason that career executives leave or move on is because if there are some executives that are very good at achieving the narrow goal. But one of the issues with narrow goals is it has a whole swathe of unintended consequences. So you might do the thing that you were meant to do, but you might be leaving a whole heap of mess and hurt in your wake. And the unintended consequences of achieving goals. So that might come back to bite them in the ass. Or it might be that one of the embedded political creatures within the established context is jealous of the success that they're having and eventually maneuver for them to be ousted. And then the third thing that happens to career executives is they finally get broken, because enterprise change is so hard. It's so hard. It's fatiguing. It's an uphill battle. It's often lonely. It's non-linear. It's fraught with frustration. And eventually, you know, they get to the point where they're like, fuck it. I just want to do my job and then switch off at the end of the day and go home, hang out with my family, and so on. And that's also kind of nice. So there's this window where there's the magic is working and someone's got that career executive mode. I love working with them. But of course, also, you know, even the ones that have kind of, all right, I'm done for now. I'm going to lay down the tools and maybe just commit to an organization for, I don't know, 6-9 years. Cool. I can still help them too. And so can you. So where am I at? Oh, yeah, I was going to make another point about the propaganda and performative elements. I mean, enterprise change and strategy is an internal marketing effort. It's a mythos that needs to be evoked and then translates to an external one. But there is ideologies that need to be converted to see a vision. And I don't know, it's hard to actually explain, because it's emergent, mythopoetic narrative work that can be beautiful when it evokes, because narratives and the myth and the symbols and stuff like that can cohere and galvanize effort towards achieving a complex goal. Beautiful to witness. Anywho, I'll get to describing how I approach strategic offsides now. But remember, strategy doesn't come from strategic offsides. It comes from relationality. It comes from seniors, collective genius. It comes from attending with curiosity to what is emerging, and then having the experimentation and the orientations to ensure that we're working towards future relevance. And I just want to also point out the best way that I've done this is with like a full quest augmented strategy approach. This is a program that I have done in various forms with various organizations, all of them under non-disclosure agreements, because we're talking about strategic differentiation. But usually how it works is you have an internal core strategic innovation team that are full-time looking at strategy, looking at trends, looking at what is emerging. This team is bolstered via rotating secondments. So you have folks from within different parts of the organization come and spend time with the strategic innovation team. They are cultivating a quiver of options, strategic initiatives that we're paying attention to and we're monitoring. They're sharing this within the organization via lunch and learns and open forums. They have budget to access experts with their in deep conversations with really quite articulate questions, so that they can better sense make what is emerging. And then because the organization, because this is cultivation of in-house intelligence and wisdom and wit, they're positioned to know when the time is to start experimenting and when the time is to start going to market with things. It's like they're not caught unawares. They're not blindsided by things like artificial intelligence, because they've been paying attention and they've been participating in this. In 2015, I was working with a team that were actively monitoring artificial intelligence. Of course, this is before the large language model innovation burst, but they are doing very well. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah, all of this stuff takes at least 3 months, normally 18 months, to get the momentum going. And you know, it's where we set up the relational contexts for participatory learning and sense making within emergent domains. Yeah. But, you know, whilst that's the ideal way to do things, at least as I see it, if someone wants to hire me to do a strategic offsite, or if they want to hire you and they're not doing any of that stuff and it's just a day that they have together, or a couple of days or 3 days or whatever, here's an approach that you can take that still allows you to dance with emergence, even if the conditions aren't quite optimal. So, I had a good nine here. Anything that has us dance amidst emergence, at the edge of knowledge, and in the confluence of diverse perspectives with a view to orientate towards future relevance. Useless note for when I'm doing a live podcast, but it's a good line. I'll include that in the post. So I'm going to share the question here. Now that we're 55 minutes into the podcast, I might be able to, well, now we've got the preamble out of the way. Now we can do the question itself. And this comes from a previous client of mine, and she's an absolute legend in her own right. She's in a very different kind of, well, somewhat different kind of country and political context to where I'm based here in Australia. She's in the Northern Hemisphere. She asked me the following question, and this was just casually within a LinkedIn back channel, but I kind of answered and I gave her a response, but I thought, maybe I'll just share, pick a podcast. Her question is, and I'm cutting it out of a larger context here. When you're facilitating strategy offsites, how much are you a facilitator and how much do you give inspiration or input or challenge them on content? I just facilitated a workshop for a segment team and I found myself well-equipped to take them through the thought process, but totally lacked the intuition or the ideas to bring out-of-the-box thinking in. Luckily, we had someone who's good at that stepping in on occasion to add some novel spin that'll help them set themselves apart from the competition. But I'd be curious to know about your approach or role in these situations. And it's a good question, right? Because already there's an acknowledgement that much of the conversation is... much as going into a strategy offsite is having the disposition for acuity where we're paying attention to emergence. That's what we're tending to. But the thing is being, there's like an attunement. This is where it gets a little bit magical. There is a sense, the best preparation anyone can do, whether they're a participant or a facilitator of a strategy offsite, is be well rested. I'm talking of an emergent domain, not an established context. Is to be well rested, and then to perhaps even meditate beforehand. And then when you enter the room, there's an attention played to the layout, to the lighting, to the energetics of how people arrive. You're sensing in, are people arriving frazzled? Have people been stuck in traffic on the way in? Like where we are? And then there's much of the work is energetic work. It's getting folks into psychophysiological disposition that has them well regulated with the guards down and open to more qualitative nebulous sense making. And that means that we have to dance between order and chaos. There's enough structure that there's coherence, but it's not super ordered. This is another thing I see a lot of facilitators fall in this trap of, is they have their toolkit, they have their sequence, they have their run sheet and agenda and their plan. When I'm in conversation with a client, I want to make sure that the catering is flexible, that we're not stuck to having to wrap up by, 12:30 or 1 p.m. because lunch is getting served at this time and stuff like that. Because if we might be in deep flow, and it's like, fuck lunch, so, that can wait. If we're where we need to be conversationally, we need to stay there. So there needs to be inherent fluidity and flex to how we structure the day itself. I guess what I'm saying is that there's a lot to pay attention to, but the way that we show up is with that intuition. It's with wit, the acuity for synthesizing disparate knowledge together in a form that is relevant and timely and apt. There's a sense of realizing that three times now that person in the corner has went to go say something but then held back, and there's this interesting tension here, and you need to kind of surface the unspoken. So I say a lot of facilitators go in and they're too rigid. And even when it comes to people contributing things, they'll go around in a line and everyone will have exactly the same time. And I get that Nancy Klein, who wrote the wonderful 10 qualities of a thinking environment, where I get the term thinking and draft from. She talks about the importance of equity or equitable time, where everyone's got this equality. Remind me, there's an article about how the word equity got completely mangled by a meme, and scholars can't stand this meme. But anyway, you just don't want to go in with that rigidity. No, not everyone needs the same equal time to speak. In different contexts, in a leadership development context, maybe, but in a strategy development context, not necessarily. So we don't want to be too rigid. We don't want to be too white, if that makes sense. By white, I mean we're polite, we're valuing the kind of written word, we're all orderly, we're keeping things civil and nice the whole time. We want to be messy, organic. We want to be as real as we can. We want to be relational. We want to feel like a spirited conversation amongst friends. Friends that know we have each other's backs and we hold each other in high regard and we're enthusiastic for each other. We have only the best wishes for each other, but also we are vigorously engaged with what is best for us collectively. So that means there's humor in that. And anyway, I responded to this person and this is how I said it. as for strategy offsites, I'd say that for the first third, I'm offering provocation and frameworks to deepen the conversation, along with pattern disrupts and frame breaks to keep the more skeptical or senior or jaded folk on board. Then for the second third, I'm mostly facilitating, but listening closely for where tension could be held longer and where ideas might be challenged. The goal here is to resist premature collapse of the possibility space and to create the conditions for generative ambiguity so that unforeseen, novel, and truly emergent options might reveal themselves. But this requires that things cook for a bit. Usually in the middle third, the true agenda reveals itself. Not the stated one, but the true agenda, along with all the hidden commitments and conflicting values and shadow work that the team needs to navigate. Then in the final third, by then, I've hopefully made myself redundant and I'm mostly focused on staying out of the way and allowing the group to self-organize and flow. So that's what I shared. It's a bit overly simplistic as a response, hence why I'm here with you now. But let me see what other dot points I've got for you. By the way, I'm hoping this is useful. I'm now an hour in. I'm starting to doubt, like, what have I done? You know, this is this haphazard thinking and draft that I'm sharing about a process that is itself kind of contextual, contingent, nebulous, dynamic, non-fixed, emergent, bricolage that I even, you know, ask me again in a year's time and I'll probably have changed it a bit then too. Anyway, I'm hoping you can sift some gems out of this. So ideally there has been a cultivation of some strategic, you know, or some options in the lead up to the offsite, combined with a shared sense of the questions that are most pertinent to cover. This is usually the non-obvious and the entangled stuff. By that I mean, folks aren't just coming into the room blind. Nor have they been given a bloody 90-slide PowerPoint deck or some Word document that is junked up with all sorts of content that they're supposed to read beforehand. It's just, you know, as I say, like, it's much more of a career advancement strategy in many organizations to broadcast that you're doing the work than it is to actually do the work itself. And we tend to value effort more than we value value, which ultimately results in this kind of proliferation of all of this busy work that distracts from the core thing at hand. The reason that you gather together for a strategic offsite is because there are tensions that are non-obvious, that aren't easy to resolve. It's not a complicated nor clear context. It's a complex context. So we need to sense mate together and contend with all of the complexities, the conflicting values, the hidden commitments. So ideally, there is some deep priming. And when I work with some clients in a deep sense, I help the leader who is calling the group together to do a handwritten letter to each person who is in attendance. A tailored handwritten letter to prime them, or an audio note, or a private podcast, something that the folks can listen to on their journey to the offsite. There's something mythic about the journey that is taken to a destination. It is nice to have an offsite that is not too convenient. You don't want to do an offsite in the center of the CBD. You don't want to do an offsite within your building of work because that's not an offsite. You'll be distracted by all of the conditioned defaults. We need perspective. We need distance. What we want to do is get into a meta-rational, meta-systemic stance so that it really helps to step out of the organization. This is why some people play with Lego for some strategy conversations, because it kind of forces a metasystemic perspective, because you're literally creating a symbolic representations of the very things that you're looking to change. And so that's useful as a frame break. Being offsite is useful too. There ought to be like high trust, as I mentioned. You want your leaders to have got things in order before they arrive. They've delegated the things. They have actually got the time. They've got the time to be present with each other. And I've already mentioned well-regulated, You know, on the first day when folks arrive, it's nice to have an early dinner. You know, they've checked into their room, get together, we'll get some context. We also make sure that, you know, folks have a sense of the contextual flow, but we also want to make sure that we make the most of the location. I once did a strategy offsite in Fiji, where we're in a room that had no windows for 3 days. This is not my choosing. No windows for 3 days. And then there was like set dinners and all of that. It was just nuts. We were hardly any. Yeah. So, you know, it's nice. I remember once I did an offsite with the Global Enterprise Services team with Telstra, and we're in the Blue Mountains, and we integrated this beautiful forest walk. We had an activity that I had with the billiards table that was in the room there, where each person got to take a shot. And there's something about mixing up the modes and the formats that allows for this beautiful serendipitous and emergent conversation to be had, where we are flirting with the novel and pathways. We're flirting with the conditions that allow for emergence. We're not tackling the thing straight on. There's a requisite obliquity. There's a surreptitious approach to this. There's a tending to the context. There's a lot of, like, you know, hidden deft work into surfacing this. And, you know, I'm hoping, I mean, I get excited as I share this. And I hope that this is like enlivening for you too. It's a beautiful thing to bring bright minds together in a shared context and ask each other the questions we're asking ourselves, and to really dance at the edge of knowledge, and to know that we actually have the capacity to coordinate and influence an impactful change to how we do things and the impact that we can have. It ripples, ripple effects. So a nice early night on day one, but a late night on day two, because the magic that happens by then, because on day two, we do all that shadow work, the things surface, like the tensions between two leaders that were simmering below the surface kind of are revealed, and the deeper hurt and the things are shared, and kind of we realize the bigger resolving. This is like leadership team dynamics, but then also the kind of the hazarded like idea, like just this half fake thing of like, yeah, I've been looking at what these folks over here in this completely unrelated industry are doing. And I reckon we can do something like this too. And I was like, yeah, I was thinking that's idea too. And this boom, this beautiful kind of thing blossoms. Or the kind of the conflicting values where you've got like, yes, we really value this, but we've got our long-term clients that want this and we don't want to piss them off. And it seems like we have to choose one or the other, but then this third way emerges and oh, it's great. anyway, that's how we do a great, you know, custom offsite. But I'm going to just assume here you're doing a standard one where you've just been called in as an external, as I'm often called in just to do half a day priming or a 90-minute session just to maybe evoke some thinking beyond the default. You know, maybe it's one of those offsite theaters where you've got to like put post-it notes on the wall and vote for the best initiatives. Or maybe it's just like an established routine SWOT analysis, you know, where you can pretty much guarantee that you'll overvalue your strengths, undervalue your weaknesses. When it comes to opportunities, you'll mention artificial intelligence. When it comes to threats, you'll talk geopolitical. You'll probably mention artificial intelligence as well. Completely predictable, underwhelming success. But yeah, I still speak to those contexts. Why not? But let's assume that we're like tending towards emergence here. And, you know, this rule of three, like thinking of like a first third, I say rule, but I mean like a, you know, stance. One, two, three, the first third, you are providing provocations and frameworks. So, you know, before we get there, okay, I'm looking at my notes here and we're eventually going to get to answering the question. I'm going to try to keep this under 90 minutes. Yeah. Remember, you still got a client and you still got to honor the client's thing. So you want to ask them, what do you want people to think, feel, and do differently as a result of this event? And what are your hopes and dreams for this? Like, are there any key things that we have to tick off? So I try to keep the key things that we have to tick off to a minimum, because if we have a clear outcome that needs to be manufactured, it will be manufactured. Anything can be contrived. Any offsite can achieve any goal, and it's just a pantomime. Like, yeah. And I try to be overt with that. Like, yes, of course, we'll do the thing and we'll get the goal. And yeah, but the hopes and dreams, that's the interesting thing. With all of these things, we want to bypass or sidestep the obvious stuff. We don't want to get things collapse into machine mode. Machine mode is where we are metric obsessed. We have a fixation upon things as though they were complicated or clear systems relating in a linear fashion. And instead, we want to open up mythic mode. We want to step into something that is much more relational and imaginal and liminal and emergent, where we're flirting with possibility. And by that, hopes and dreams allows us to kind of sense into like, well, what really, you say to your client, what really is your hopes and dreams here? Like, are there any tensions that you kind of want resolved or relieved? Or what would make you feel really pleased as you're driving home from this offsite and you think about the different characters who are in attendance here, and you think, you know what, I'm really glad that this happened, or, you know, what are those things? And you start to kind of get them thinking in that warmer, more dissolved, more relational sense. I should actually get on with this. Let's assume you looked at the room, you've gotten there early, you're helping to facilitate this offsite. We're doing the three acts. Now, first, as I say, it's provocations and frameworks. You are going to get people that will come in to the room. You know, there will be skeptical folk. There'll be distracted folk. There will be shy and intimidated folk. There'll be folk that are posturing and already taking up space. There are a bunch of characters that will enter in. Some will be on their phones and their laptops. Some will be really lovely and nice and asking, is there anything that you need? Some will be making jokes. Some will be on their phone in the corner. Like, the thing that we want to do here initially is really warm and bring the space together. We need to have a sense of genuine equality amongst the room, in the sense of there's no big dick swinging kind of power games here. There's like everyone's on the same playing field. So sometimes there's a little bit of humor directed towards like the more powerful ones, just to kind of humble them up a little bit. And sometimes it's warm and encouraging for the quieter voices and so on. You can't be too overt with this, because if you're warm and encouraging to the quiet voice, if you get the tone wrong, not wrong, there's no rights or wrongs, but you need to just be mindful, because that come across as patronizing. And, you know, if you misread the energetics with the kind of quiet booming voice, sorry, the quiet, if you misread the context with the large booming voice within the room, and you deploy humor in that regard, they might bristle up and get even more defensive and so on. So there's a lot of deft acuity that comes from experience working in these complex domains. But the point is, we want warm relational foundations here. The first thing I often do is an autobiographical reflection that has people reflect on what's brought them to this moment. And it's a chance for them in pairs initially, and sometimes we switch up the pairs. And sometimes I mix it up if I feel like people have kind of automatically come together in default posses. But we have them qualitatively sense, make, and reflect what's brought them to this moment. This also allows a bit of a pressure release, because sometimes, you know, I had another layer to this where I get them to reflect, like if there was a single word that might summarize or distill the theme of the last 12 months, what would that word be? And sometimes there's a chance where people actually just genuinely say, look, it's been really hard. Like, I've got a teenage child who's been self-harming and in school, and I think they're suffering from cyberbullying, and I just don't know what to do, and it's been so scary. And and then the work context, and other people will be like, you know, I don't know, I've come here and I felt so intimidated, and I had major imposter syndrome going on, and it's taken me a while. Like, I still, like, you know, I'm new to the town, and it's actually taken a while to find. There's just beautiful things that kind of emerge, and then suddenly we're like, fuck, what a beautiful mix of complex people we have here. And there's this reminder that everyone is fighting hidden battles that we just don't know of. So the thing is, be kind, you know, be kind. And there's this beautiful thing, and I love this, where even the skeptical person who had his arms kind of folded at the start, he or she is like really warmed and leaning into this. And there's this beautiful space. And from there, we can start to talk about, you know, strategy. We disambiguate it a bit. We understand what we're talking about here is relevance realization. We're orientating towards future relevance. I'll sometimes do downward comparison while I talk about what will typically happen on an offsite. I shared this earlier in the podcast, but you do have busy executives that are very good at bluffing their way through most complex conversations. But you know, and everyone's kind of mostly concerned with just making sure that their own turf is largely unaffected so they can get back to their work as usual. And a lot of people relate to this, but we need to understand that the result is that collectively we fail. If everyone's just focused on their own turf and we're not coordinating and we're not rising to the complexity of our times, if we're not seeking the synergies, if we're not looking after each other, then the team will fall apart. And so here's a chance for us to compare notes, come together and see how we can coordinate more effectively amidst complexity and change so that we have genuine strategic differentiation, a strategy that we believe in, a strategy that we're mostly aligned to. And even if it's a constellation of visions, it's still a directionality that we can align to. And then we're also able to kind of carry the light of this conversation and shine a light on the path for others to follow within the organization. And we're going to do so with that, you know, deepened collegiality, respect, and relational rapport with each other. And we're going to have each other's backs. And we want everyone on the team to know that you don't have to do this alone. We're all in this together. You know, the beautiful context weaving, right? And then for provocation, I would often have the business model canvas by Strategizer and the operating system canvas by The Ready. Two wonderful organizations, two wonderful books, Business Model Strategy and the Business Model Canvas and the Brave Work book. Brave New Work by Aaron Dignan. Fantastic books. And within each of them, there's a framework with the business model, got key partnerships, key activities, key resources, value proposition, customer segments, key channels, key relations, the cost and revenue. With the operating system canvas, you've got innovation, strategy, authority, incentives, rhythm, and other things like that, how the organization works. We take a bit of a tour of both of these things. And then we'll frame something up as like, imagine if you were, you know, the books that if you have vision impairment, it's like has the braille, like the textured things. And you can look at these canvases that have been effectively shared within the room itself. Of course, I bring the books. I'm not doing copyright infringement here. I bring the books. It's all due attribution. This is more just a provocation. And usually I've primed the folks with the books beforehand, so don't sue me. But you kind of brush your fingers, the fingers of your mind, across these canvases. And where do we snag? And of course, if we're doing this as part of the longer quest augmented strategy, we would have had experience exploring multiple future domains and narrativizing them. And then we'd be looking for where the common incoherencies lie across multiple future contexts, because what we're looking for is the adjacent possible. We're not looking to kind of completely revolutionize everything we do, because that's a huge effort investment. And often we're very close to profound new ways of doing things. It's just the adjacent possible, if we're just to look at the infinite possibility, that's wonderful from the infinite game perspective, but we actually need to kind of also have a foot in reality of where we're at now. So we're scanning these canvases. We're trying to look at if we think about it into the future and into multiple futures, what are we doing now that won't make sense or doesn't make sense? And so people have a sense there. And then next, I usually get them to, because with skeptical folk in the room, folks that have endured and suffered through consultants with their whiteboard markers and their flip charts and their post-it notes and their bag of tricks, they'll have seen most of the things beforehand. So one of the things I will sometimes throw in is an activity around a question. If we were to sabotage the efficacy of this organization, if we were to subtly, insidiously sabotage our ability to achieve the goals that we set out, the reputation that we have, and all the good work that has been done to lead us to this moment. If we wanted to commit to being irrelevant in the next few years, how might we subtly yet insidiously do this? I'll have them broken up into little teams, imagining that we're part of, like in Get Smart, where you have the cone of silence go on. And so you have these conspiring teams where they're sabotaging their own business. And it's so funny. You see this Machiavellian kind of perverse glee come out of some folks. As they're like, oh, I know exactly how to do this. And then you get this kind of very sincere, ironic humorous, like where they point out the many things that they're already doing to sabotage success. And this is what I mean. This is the role of jester. A lot of truth is said in jest. And it's through this unanticipated Aikido move, instead of going against or with the predictable format, we do the Aikido move. We flip them over. And before they know it, they're stumbled into surfacing the black mirror of what strategy could be. Very hilarious if we have these actually written up on flip charts and post-it notes, because any observer will look at things like, you know, we need to add more layers of hierarchy to the organization, or we need to encourage the formation of more silos. Having said that, silos are a very efficient way to work. And so the silos aren't automatically bad. They just need to be networked within the organization and porous. So anyway, these are all fascinating things. And sometimes you realize that the different teams have had very different perspectives. And so very different things are very different options altogether. One team is like saying, we need to outsource all of our comms to artificial intelligence as a form of self-sabotage. The other person is saying, or the other team is saying, oh, we need to eschew technology and hire expensive onshore staff for all of our contact centers. And then you're like, oh, this is interesting. And this is the point here. Part of the role of the external facilitator is to facilitate the conditions for emergence. We need to tend to emergence. And what we need here is to surface diversity of perspectives. My point is, we need to create the conditions for emergence. And this can be so enlivening. There's humor, there's wit, there's this kind of paradoxical approach to surfacing what needs to be said. Of course, we stop pretending that we're sabotaging here. We realize that we're, you know, double agents, and we're actually, you know, have the organization tattooed upon our bosom, and we're loyalists and all of that. And then we can look at, okay, if we didn't want to sabotage the organization, if we wanted to move closer towards meaningful progress rather than the delusion of progress, what might we do? And then there's an interesting thing here. And by then, you, the facilitator, have attuned to the characters, the energetics in the room. You've been tending quietly. And there is almost like this shamanic kind of acuity and attunement that you have. And as the conversation's happening, you know when in this middle third that we've gotten to, when we want to hold tension, when we want to you know, bring about provocative ideas, or just kind of challenge, or just share things so that we can get a sense of like any unquestioned assumptions, any conflicting values, any hidden commitments, anything that may not be voiced. And so what we're wanting to do here, and, you know, sometimes, you know, I've said things like, I feel a real tension here, because there seems to be this unspoken thing where I don't know what I'm missing here. People just don't, anytime I mention this particular thing, I notice just groups tend to go quiet, and I notice people looking at each other, and what am I missing here? And this is where you, the external, have weaponized naivete. I say weaponized more as a, it sounds cool, but I mean in the sense that like you can use your naivete to great effect, because you're like, I don't get it. What's going on? Why does it work like this? And normally what's underneath it all is either some perverse incentive or some sort of nepotism or some sort of unspoken taboo that you, the trickster, have just evoked. And giving voice to that, and this, you need to be really careful about how you encourage and hold these spaces and that kind of the energy and the attention that you give, and really honoring anyone who contributes into the space, because we're right at the precipice of something beautiful and transformational and dynamic. And these moments that are exquisite, people are, you know, there's a cognitive exhaustion that comes from a good offsite. There's a lot that we've kind of been covering, but we're well regulated and grounded so we can go here. But there's this beautiful thing in an event where you get to these moments and then people reveal. And so, you know, sometimes I know I'm blending a leadership thing here. This probably doesn't sound like a strategy to a lot of people, but it unblocks a lot of what's going on within a leadership team. And I've done this for so many teams, including teams of, you know, alpha males with their suits and their armor and their professional facades and so on, that just kind of dissolve and melt and just, And that the result of this from a team dynamic thing is so exquisite. But that what comes also on the other side here is a deeper trust and a willingness to be creative, imaginative, collaborative, to explore. Because when we're feeling time poor, when we're feeling energetically depleted and badly regulated, we're more likely to focus on our own goals. We're more likely to close down. We're more likely to be conservative with the energy we invest into things. We're more likely to focus on our own turf rather than lean into collaboration and possibility and emergence. And so all of this work come in that middle third bit, surfaces these things. Then we can start to tap into the overall context of the strategic offsite. The things that in the briefing call, they say these are the kind of domains we want to cover, and we really need to kind of review the plan here and just make sure everyone's on board with this. And these departments need to figure out what they're doing here and how they're going to allocate budget for this and so on. We can do that. And by then, things are going to be humming in a really nice way most of the time. Not all the time, most of the time. Sometimes in afternoon tea breaks, you need to do a little bit of coaching and stuff to go on. But like it is exhausting and it's beautiful. We get to this point where beautiful things are flowing. And by then you kind of, ideally, you're starting to make yourself a little bit more scarce, just lightly facilitating. This is not your show anyway. It's their show. You've set the conditions. Now you just step back and you lightly tend to things. The key thing I'd also point out is you really hope that the team have a team dinner. This is where bonds are restored, because there's been, you know, it's, when I can only speak for the things that I facilitate, but they are profound and transformational most of the time. And there is something so beautiful about what emerges. But when people can come together for dinner, and I always brief my client that this needs to be a mythic moment. Like when people break bread together, there is something so significant. There's a round of toasts with like appreciation for folks. There's now, let's assume that the offsite wraps up the next morning, right? So we can kind of do the galvanizing, get all your priority list and so on sorted out. I'll tell you about the thing that I usually end an offsite with. But this dinner is so important and profound. So as an external, I suggest that, you know, maybe you stay if it feels appropriate for the start of the dinner. But you also want to then give them space. Now, sometimes it makes sense for you to stick around, but your job's not done. You're probably going to be exhausted. I know I'm exhausted by the end of such days. So it's time for you to go have a bath and an early night. I'd be ready for the next day. But you're hoping that the team will just stick around, and you make sure that the next morning doesn't start too early. You want folks to have reflective time the next morning. Ideally, you have some folks, most of the team, ideally all of it, but most of the team staying up at the bar late at night. Just doesn't have to be an alcohol thing. Alcohol can help, but it doesn't have to be. The point is, we're in a shared, very rare, very special context here, where even deeper truths and connections and collegiality and rapport and relationality can be deepened and developed. And the next morning, people sleep. They start, there's mingling over breakfast, maybe. There's reflective walks and so on. And by then, we have a clear sense of the strategy. We have a clear sense of what we're doing and why we're doing it together. We're not so hung up if the details aren't quite there, because we understand we're all on the same page here. We're all on the same side. There's a comfort or a confidence in saying, you know, as I was saying yesterday, I'm really worried because the way my department's incentives are set up is that we're meant to be hitting this target. I can see that this target, though, with the strategy we've got, I can see that that target is not actually going to be relevant given what we've talked about. I get that. I'm not fighting that. I was fighting that. I was sabotaging that beforehand. I get it. And I'm fighting that. I just hope that we can also just, you know, I've got a good team here, really good talent. And when I communicate this change to them, I just want to be able to, really assure them that they're going to be okay. And with this new strategy, we're going to have a home for them and so on. You know, these are the things that need to be surfaced. Because otherwise, you'll have people sabotage the strategy and resist the emergence and resist the orientation towards relevance realization, because from their perspective, they're also looking after their team of talent that they've nurtured and mentored in order to achieve the targets that were set in the last strategy. And by then, as I say, the last third, you're mostly out of the way. people by this stage are pretty good because the emergent context is going back into like an established form, this special kind of space of generative ambiguity that you've kind of attended to and created, this mythic pocket where the liminal, imaginal and possibilities have emerged. That's starting to dissolve. People are starting to get into their transition. Okay, we've got to get into execution mode here. I'm going to start laying out plans. I need to figure out what meetings I need to have, how I'm going to communicate this with my team and so on. But there's something really special. And before we finish the offsite, I usually like to end these things with everyone going around and just doing a response of two questions. What am I grateful for and what am I excited about? It sounds naff, but it's really beautiful, particularly when we get to nuanced gratitudes and excitement. So I usually try to set it up not too generic, like I'm really grateful, such a nice team, and I'm excited about the future. We need to be more like, I'm really grateful that we had time to talk about blah, because these things we never get time to talk about this. And I just felt really seen and heard about this. And I'm really excited to know that next time I'm in interstate and stuff like that, I genuinely feel like I can call you up and we can do lunch or dinner together. Like it feels like we actually have a deeper connection, you know? And then the thing is, you don't go around each person taking turns, you get the person to then choose who goes next. So there's like, you're not sure who goes next and that person thanks the person. These are all like little facilitatory tricks that you accrue over time, but there's something beautiful about this. Anyway, so we've revealed the true agenda. We've facilitated a transformational offsite. Now, that's a naff word that's often used in a corporate context, but quietly, I know the work that I've done and the work that you may do with the offsites that you facilitate, you may have heard it, like we're crossing boundaries here. We're transgressing between strategies. Is it leadership development? Is it adult development? Is it relational development? What's going on here? Is it team development? It's all of the things in the context of strategy development, but we're attending to the quickening magics of emergence. We're enlivening the strategy by having it warm and relational. And we are provisioning time to venture into the underworld. We're doing the shadow work. We're surfacing the unspoken truths. We're surfacing that which needs to be said, that which would otherwise never emerge in most contexts. We're exorcising the demons that may have been holding this team back. We're doing so many things here in a powerful, catalyzing offsite that has folks emboldened. And when I say clear on the strategy, it's not mean that there's a perfect, clear strategic plan as a result of this. That will emerge. And as I say before, planning is part propaganda, the plans and so on. But there's a shared, clear sense of directionality, a clear sense of alignment, a deeper, clearer trust about the team that we have. And this is all a beautiful thing. And I had a friend ask me recently, because I've been showing up in a mode that's been complaining a lot about where we are in the world and what's happening, and me pointing out and warning about a lot of the things that we're not paying enough attention to. And partly, you know, there's a parallel to most folklores. In most folklore, the fables are pointing out what not to do, but they don't necessarily tell you what to do. And the reason for that is you want to preserve the possibility of novel pathways emerging. There are pitfalls that you can avoid, but we don't know what might yet emerge. We don't want to name it too early. We don't want to collapse the possibility space. We don't want to say, this is the goal that we're working to achieve, or these are the outcomes that we want specifically. Otherwise, we collapse the field and we go and achieve those outcomes and it's an underwhelming success. A box ticking 4 out of 5, underwhelming success. Instead, we want the kind of thing that people will be talking about in years to come, the hinge of history, the kind of the way that a team has pivoted from middling mediocrity and incrementalism into something that's profoundly enlivening, galvanizing, and really orientated towards future relevance and genuine value. That's a good strategy offsite. Anyway, so long story short, that's how you might approach facilitating a strategy offsite. If you have a client that is genuinely interested in an emergent domain rather than just perfecting incremental improvements within an established domain. I hope that there's something useful amongst that. At some point soon, I'll have comments reactivated on my blog at foxwizard.com. Yes, but wherever you're seeing this video or hearing this podcast, if there is, Look, I just want to say, if there's anything else that you want to add into the mix based upon your experience as a facilitator, a complexity practitioner, someone who may also be a career executive and has picked up a few meta-rational wisdoms or sensibilities and savvy, I'd love to hear it. We'd all love to hear it. My stance with all these things is these things should not be proprietary or secret. We're in a world now where intelligence, in the sense of artificial intelligence, means that it's very easy to get content, right? But sensibilities, genuine presence, authentic attunement, relational resonance, these are things that artificial intelligence can't provide. And I feel like we all need to share generously now, but also show up in a way that is present and attuned and enlivened, and really adopting the infinite game to play to continue the play. We're not playing to win, as some people do in finite approaches to strategy. We're instead playing to continue the play. Remember, as James Carr says, only that which can change can continue. Finite players play within boundaries. Infinite players play with boundaries. I hope this has played with some of the boundaries you've had with regards to strategic offsites. Thank you so much for listening to this extra long podcast, and catch you next time for a shorter one. I'm Dr. Jason Vox, and we have been leading through emergence.